A few weeks ago, Justin was preaching on the Tower of Babel, which is, I wouldn't want to preach on that text. What do you do with the Tower of Babel? But he said something like, it is when people take God's plan and try to accomplish it on their own terms that they get in trouble. And this week, we are spending our time in a story that is exactly along those lines. People taking God's plan and putting it into their own hands and resultingly getting in quite a bit of trouble. We're beginning in Genesis 12 with this. Abraham has a promise. In Genesis 12, we meet Abram and Sarai, whom in Genesis 15, God will name Abraham and Sarah, and we'll just be referring to them as that because that's the way that we know them best for the most part. And at the ripe old age of 75, Yahweh, the one true God, appears to Abraham and offers him a deal. He says, if Abraham will leave everything that he knows, his country, his people, and his father's household, and go to the land that God will show him, that God will bless him. God promises to make Abraham into a great nation, to bless him, to make his name great, to make him a blessing, to bless those who bless him and curse those who curse him, and in the end, to bless all peoples on earth through him. And that's quite the promise, but it requires a heavy investment. It's no small thing, as some of us know, it's no small thing to leave everything that you're familiar with behind, especially in order to follow a God that you can't see. It's hard to leave what you can see in order to follow a God that you cannot see. But the payoff is staggering. To have a mighty family name and a presence is a powerful thing now, but in the ancient world, it's almost the only thing that matters. The only thing people care about. And God has promised not only to give Abraham a family, but to make him into a great nation, one through which all peoples on earth will be blessed. And it's a good deal if you can trust in the God who guarantees it. And Abraham does believe, and as Justin told us last week, this is credited to him as righteousness. And so Abraham has got a promise. That's not the only thing Abraham has got. Abraham has got a problem. He's 75 and childless. And remember how having a big family is basically the only thing people care about in the ancient world? Well, this weighs on Abraham. And perhaps even more, it weighs on Sarah, his wife. She is 10 years younger than Abraham, but still well past prime childbearing age, and she has felt the pressure of her childlessness for decades. She notices in the facial expressions of the women she passes in the marketplace, whether it's a haughty sniff or a sympathy bearing glance or just an awkward avoidance, and this weighs on her childlessness. She wears the shame like a badge that gets bigger and brighter with every passing year. And now, at last, at the age of 65, this gust of hope has come in from nowhere. And Yahweh has promised a child. God has promised a child, not just one, but descendants as countless as the stars in the sky. At long last, Sarah's shame will be relieved. And then a month passes after God's promise. And she isn't so worried yet. Sarah knows that these things can take time even when God is in the midst. But there's no child after a month, and perhaps she worries. And then 6 months pass, and there is no child. And then 10 years pass, and there is no child. How long should you have to wait on the promise of God? Yahweh shows up again in Genesis 15 to reassure them. Abraham has this powerful vision in which God impossibly stakes his own life on the promise that he will make Abraham and Sarah into a great nation. But it has been 10 years since they have left everything behind to follow this God, and they have no baby. And they're not getting any younger. And so we come to Genesis chapter 16, and we read this. Now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. And so she said to Abram, "The Lord, Yahweh, has kept me from having children." And we see here that Sarah has isolated the source of her problem. "It is the Lord who has prevented me from having children." That Sarah thinks this is not shocking. Many in the ancient world thought that if a family was unable to have children, that must be the gods cursing them. But this is also so deeply connected to the delay of the fulfillment of what God has promised. The relief of sudden and unexpected divine hope that rushed into Sarah's life at the promise, this has curdled. This has not just shaken her faith, it has turned her into a bitter person. And later, when God comes to visit once more, when God comes to visit Abram and Sarah, and Sarah will laugh at the suggestion that God would keep his promises. There is no hope left in her. She is hurting and feels that God has let her down. And this will inspire her toward disastrous action. So Sarah has isolated the source of the problem. "Yahweh has kept me from having children." And she has concocted a clean solution to the Lord's shortcoming. See, when Abraham and Sarah were passing through Egypt, as Justin told us last week, some things went sideways. Abraham is terrified by Sarah's beauty. He's afraid that it will attract the attention of Pharaoh and that Abraham's life will be threatened. And so he makes Sarah say she is his sister. And Pharaoh does indeed scoop her up and intend to make her his wife. And he showers Abraham with gifts as a bride price. Gifts of sheep, cattle, donkeys, camels, and male and female slaves. And then Yahweh steps in and afflicts Pharaoh with a host of plagues. And then Pharaoh realizes that Sarah is a married woman and angrily returns her to her husband. Now, confoundingly, it seems like a bad idea, but confoundingly, Abraham runs the exact same play later on when confronted with a powerful man who might be attracted to his wife's beauty. See, Abraham feels very comfortable putting his wife at risk if it will ensure his own safety. And now Sarah will extend this same favor to another. Sarah says to Abraham, "Go and sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Yahweh has failed to build what Sarah and Abraham want, and so they will take the blessing into their own hands. And if the means do not exactly reflect Yahweh's nature, well, he had 10 years. Abram agreed to what Sarai said. And so after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave Hagar, gained from this messy situation with Pharaoh, this deception, and this using of Sarah as a tool for Abram's own safety. Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. And he slept with Hagar, and she conceived. Now, part of the horror of the story, this is a bad story. This is not a good story. And part of the horror of it is that Abram and Sarah are not hateful. They're not monsters, they're pragmatists. They say, well, God has failed to establish what he promised, and so we will just do it for him. And getting even God's will done isn't always pretty. God isn't moving, and they've got this slave girl from the whole Egypt incident, so maybe she can be the solution. And she's just a slave, after all. And this action is all legal within the customs of the ancient world. It's not pretty, but it's above board. And she doesn't necessarily get a say in the matter, but think of the worthiness of the cause. You know, descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the grains of sand on the seashore. And through these descendants, God promises to bless all the nations of the world. There has never been a more glorious omelet for which to crack a couple of eggs. And so Hagar is the solution. She is perhaps a casualty, but she is the solution that they find. And at first, this solution seems to work. Hagar gets pregnant. But once she is pregnant, and now that she has moved from the legal status of slave to wife, she stops treating Sarah with the same deference, and that does not go over well. When Hagar knew she was pregnant, her mistress grew small in her eyes. That's a lovely Hebrew idiom. Her mistress grew small in her eyes. Then Sarai said to Abram, "May my harm be upon you. I put my slave in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she no longer respects me. May Yahweh judge between you and me." And Abram says, "Your slave is in your hands. Do whatever you think is best." We can see how far this legal shift of position from slave to wife really carries. Hagar, the solution, has now become Hagar, the problem. And Abraham, father of nations and chosen of God, bravely selects the path of least resistance. And all of this leads to an obvious conclusion. Then Sarai mistreated Hagar, and so she fled from her. Years ago, I was blessed to hear Dr. Marilyn Elliott of Asbury preach on this passage while I was in seminary. And she reflected on Abraham and Sarah's lofty aims. She said, "It's interesting that as Abraham is reveling in the promises of God that his family will bless all nations, that all the nations within his own household are being abused." Abraham's got the big picture, and the means seem to justify the ends, no matter who gets hurt. It is when God's people take God's plan and try to accomplish it on their own terms, in their own ways, that they get in trouble. So where is a pregnant woman escaping in the wilderness to go? Hagar heads south. She heads toward home. And she finds refuge at a spring of water in the wastelands, very near the boundary line to Egypt, and it is there that God finds her. The angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress Sarai," she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." The angel added, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." Now, there's a lot to unpack here. First, you have Yahweh, you have God, extending to Hagar this extraordinarily powerful promise, comparable, entirely comparable to the promise that he gives to Abraham. And it's hard to emphasize this enough. Abraham is the biggest deal in the Old Testament. It's Abraham, Moses, and God, and everyone else is a bit player compared to them. He's where everything begins. He's the progenitor of the Hebrew people, the foundation of Israel. He's the great ancestor of the Messiah that would save the world. And Hagar is a slave girl. Yet she has been painfully wounded by Abraham and Sarah's misdeeds. And God is not satisfied to let her pain go unanswered. And so he decrees that Hagar also will be the founder of a great people. That the Lord instructs her to go back to Abraham and Sarah is difficult. The Lord does not offer an explanation for this. As God has instructed Abraham to follow him into the unknown, he now instructs Hagar to return to what she knows all too well. This is not a simple redemption. It's complicated. And yet God does not send Hagar back empty-handed, but with a powerful promise and with his own presence. It is Yahweh's presence, God's presence, that gives Hagar the strength to return to Abraham and Sarah, where she and her baby will be protected and sheltered, although also surrounded by difficult family tensions. I want to direct your attention to two more things that are small in appearance, but large in importance. The angel of Yahweh, the angel of the Lord, appears to Hagar first out of anyone in Scripture. In all of the Bible, the first appearance of the angel of the Lord is here. It is not to Abraham. It is not to Moses. It is not to the prophets. It is to the pregnant slave girl who has caught every bad break, who has been overlooked in pursuit of greater purposes, but she has not been overlooked by the Lord. The angel of the Lord is the very same angel who will appear to Abraham later, and Abraham and Sarah later at the Oaks of Mamre, who speaks to Moses from the burning bush. He smites Israel's enemies, raises up prophets, confounds the powers of evil, protects and guides the nations, and he appears to Hagar first. And this tells us something about the nature of God. This tells us something about the nature of God, that God always is the one who does not overlook when others would overlook, but appears first to the one who has been most discarded. And what I'm most eager to point out to you is the first word that the angel of God says. The first word that the angel of God says is Hagar. And this is not so shocking until you realize that Abraham and Sarah have never once referred to Hagar by her name. Never once. She is always the slave girl. When she is sent into the arms of Abraham, she is the slave girl. And when Sarah is upset with how she is treated, she says, "Send the slave girl away." She is never once referred to by her name. And yet when God comes and finds her, she is not the slave girl. She is Hagar. She is known not for what she is, but for who she is. And this tells us a great deal about who God is. Abraham and Sarah speak of her only as a function. She allows for certain strategic opportunities that they would not otherwise have. But God sees who she is. She has been a gift. All her life she has been a something. She has been a gift sent to placate a wrathful God, a slave valued only for her labor, a vessel to bear a child and nothing more. But the Lord in whom dwells true power seeks her out, calls her by her name. Before God ever changes the names of Abram to Abraham and Sarai to Sarah, he comes to Hagar and he gives her child a name. He says, "Your child will be Ishmael. God hears." And having been recognized by her own name, having been granted a mighty promise and a name for her son, Hagar astonishingly returns the favor to God. She gave this name to Yahweh who spoke to her. "You are El Roi, the God who sees me." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." Have you met this God? Have you seen the God who sees you? It's been a hard week. It has been a painful time for many in our community. And sometimes it feels like we spend all our time at church talking about how Jesus came to offer us a way out of our own vices, to combat against our own worst impulses so that we can avoid the wreckage that we cause. And it's true and it's important, but our real need is far greater than that. God's salvation is far greater than that. God is El Roi, the God who sees us when everything has just fallen to pieces. When life has been unfair and hateful to us. When our lives have been shattered by the actions that others have taken. And when no one is able to see who we are beyond what we are. What we can provide or accomplish or be useful in, or what we've done or what has been done to us. I don't know how to sum up the pain in this room. It is beyond my ability. But I know that Hagar, used and discarded by the world, found in God someone who saw her truly, who met her in her moment of desperate need and joined her in walking a difficult path. I know that I, when I have found myself unseen and unknown, when I have found myself drowning in hurt that others have done to me and in my own shortcomings, in my own failures, I have found also the God who sees me. And in his gaze, as Hagar experienced, in his gaze, I do not find wrath or disappointment or disgust. I find a mercy that my bones can barely bear. A compassion that would stop at nothing to make me whole. Have you seen the God who sees you? Hagar's story is not simple and clean from here on out. God was faithful to his promise to Hagar and to Abraham and Sarah. And when Sarah finally gives birth to Isaac, the tension between them erupts and Sarah banishes Hagar from their family. It is an inauspicious beginning for the lineage through which God will bless all peoples. But yet, the callous faithlessness of Abraham and Hagar does not invalidate the faithfulness of God, who goes with Hagar into the wilderness and saves her and her boy. It is in the midst of the pain that the world brings her that Hagar meets God. And this is the good news for you too. This is the gospel for us. The God who saw Hagar is the God who sees you. And we know this because this is so consistently depicted and exampled in the life of Jesus, who is the ultimate picture of who God is. In Luke 7, Jesus meets with a well-to-do and religiously put-together Pharisee for dinner, and their meal is interrupted by someone who Luke simply describes as a sinful woman. That is all that she's described as. And she barges into this dinner, scorning all propriety, and she anoints Jesus' feet with perfumed oil and with her tears, and the Pharisee is appalled. And Jesus confronts him with one simple question. He says, "Do you see this woman?" And the answer is, of course, that he has not. He has not seen the woman. He has seen embarrassment, and he has seen shame, and above all, he has seen sin. And he is repulsed, but God is not. God sees the woman. Jesus' teaching here as he embraces, forgives, and restores this woman is this. He says, the one who has been forgiven little will love little, and the one who has been forgiven much, the one who has been brought through much, the one who has experienced great pain, that one still will find a greater love. It is the Pharisee who remains unrestored, blind to his own sin, and so unable to soften his heart to God, though God himself is sitting at the table with him. Jesus has never seen you in your most broken and wretched state and been repulsed. Never. Jesus has never seen you in all your hurts and looked away. Jesus has had his eyes fixed on you for all eternity. It is for you that he bore the cross with joy. It is for you that he lives today. I'm so thankful that Jesus, who is both the Son of God and also the friend of sinners, is the God who sees us truly, who never overlooks. He is the righteous judge who is never judgmental. He longs to embrace, forgive, and restore. Let's join together in a time of prayer.